God, I remember it like it was just yesterday.
Because it was only like a month and a half ago. It was about 2 months ago.
Yeah, that seems about right.
What's today? Oh my God, it was exactly 2 months ago.
2 months ago. Let me take you back in time. There was still a good chance that Donald Trump was just a joke.
I was just going to say, we all still had hope. Remember hope and change? Oh wait, no, that was 2008. No.
Hi, I'm Casey.
I'm Amy. So here's the thing. I'm so excited to record this podcast because this was one of the craziest nights of my entire life. We made a book out of this fucking show. Yes. Can you believe it? Can you believe someone? So I think we should start by telling the story of the book. So we do shows every year, which you can find on this podcast and elsewhere, in New York for New York Comic Con. And it was the first ever show that we did for New York Comic Con. And this is an embarrassing story about your girl here, is I accidentally got like sort of blackout falling down drunk during the first New York Comic Con show because I was so fucking nervous about it. And it was Watchmen, and it was great, and it was a great show. There's a little bit of Twitter drums, but it was mostly fine. So the show ended, and I was like, thank God that's over. And I was so drunk. Maybe the drunkest I've ever been after a show. And I go stumbling out into the hallway to check in with our booksellers from Word Brooklyn. Holla! Go to Word if you're in New York. And just make sure that they were okay and that they sold some stuff. And a woman walked up to me and tapped me on the shoulder. And she said, hi, I'm Maddie. And I said, what's happening? Where am I? Who is talking? And she introduced herself. She gave me a business card. And she said, I'm an editor at Grand Central. And I love your show. I'm obsessed with it. I run a feminist romance book club. And they dragged me here. And I think this show is a book. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, I think you could make a book out of this show. And I apparently gave her my business card. And promised her that within a week I would turn around a book proposal. And then I went off to enjoy the rest of my night, which I don't remember at all. When I think back on this conversation, I'm horrified because I can picture myself, and this is true, using my hand to steady myself against the wall because I was afraid if I stood up under my own power in my high heels, I would be swaying. And yet, I went home, and within a week, I turned out a book proposal and submitted it, and the rest is history. So, 2 years later, our book actually happened. We called it Loose Lips.
Yeah.
Because we have a show called Shipwreck, and the Loose Lips sink ships. And I still kind of can't believe it happened. Still kind of feels like it didn't really happen.
That's the weirdest thing about it.
We worked on it for a solid year every single day.
We worked a lot. Like, a lot of work.
We worked our asses off.
For a book that was 98% written by other people, we wrote some essays in it. But we went through 3 years worth of material, and we selected the pieces that we wanted to use, and we arranged them thematically, and we went back and forth with copy editors and argued about the capitalization of the word dumpster.
True.
And
turns out the dumpster, and this got changed right after we finished our final draft, but it turns out dumpster is a trademark.
Yeah, and we fought for lowercasing it, and
sure enough,
time outed us. We survived. We survived that. We right. Made the right choice. History proved
is
us
on
right.
our side. History is on our side.
But yeah, you'd be amazed. Like, we had big kid arguments. We had big kid conversations with professional artists and professional book designers and professional copywriters about our dick jokes.
Mm-hmm.
An entire world of professional lawyers.
We learned that C-U-M is a noun and C-O-M-E is a verb. That Absolutely. Is the thing that I learned during the process of this book.
Amazing stuff. And the fact that so many adult professionals took us seriously.
Yeah, a team of lawyers, you guys, worked on this book. An actual team of them.
Yeah. And all the while, it never felt real, despite the fact, I mean, we took pictures of it. We've
done events for it.
I know. I worked on it in Hawaii on vacation. We submitted draft after draft of this thing. We wrote essays that we were told were not up to par. And we revised those essays and rewrote them. And actually, like, we hunkered in and went deep.
Dude, I gotta tell you, our essays are funny.
They were.
I couldn't believe it. When we got the first, the galleys of the book, I read our essays and actually laughed out loud. like the anachronisms of like you, like the whole crux of the essay is like, I'm the responsible adult telling the story about the thing, and Casey's in the back like clumsily trying to start a fire, and it's so like, why does it work? It's so funny.
I don't know. I think it plays.
It plays. I couldn't believe, like, I never thought that I would be able to laugh at it after all the work we put into it. But, like, I came back to it and I was like, we're funny. Like, we're funny.
It really does take a village. I think that's the thing, is it's both like, dreamlike, yep, like, while you're coming through the process. And at the end, you're both, it's kind of a letdown to make a book. And it's beyond exciting. Like, it's a letdown because it happened. And you expect you expect to somehow be elevated as a human being, like to another level.
Well, to me, it's a letdown, not because I expect to be elevated, because I don't ever expect to be elevated. I expect to be a trash fire for the rest of my life. But to me, it's a letdown because it's like over.
Yeah, you're riding a wave. Yeah. You're riding a wave, and then you have a party for the event.
And then you're like, okay, what's next?
And then you're like, oh shit, I got to start all over.
Everyone's like, what's next? And you're like, but I didn't even celebrate that. Never mind. Fine. No, anyway, so all that to say, enormous thanks to my soul twin, Maddie Caldwell, who I love with my whole heart, who just posted a Murder She Wrote photograph to Instagram, by the way. I don't know if you caught that, but I did, and I had a fucking heart attack, and I took everything in me not to call her office phone and leave a message being like, hi, by the way, I love you.
She's the best human being on earth. She's and the when best we went fucking in human. For the our meeting with them, we thought we were pitching them the book.
No,
and opposite. They were pitching them to our book.
So when we said we went in, that was October of 2014 that we got approached to do a book proposal. In May of 2015. In May of 2000, we've been recording for a long time. In May of 2015, we went back to New York and we sat down in a room with Maddie, and we thought for sure we were going to have to sell ourselves because we hadn't heard anything yet. And it turned out Maddie delivered us the best pitch for our show. If I could write a pitch for our show, it wouldn't have been as good as Maddie's pitch for why our show is the best. And I still think about it. It breaks my heart. I could not believe how much someone who only saw the show one time gave a shit about it. And it just, I still get all like reclumped when I think about it. She was amazing. She's still amazing. She's always amazing.
It was in a glass room, and they gave us bottled water.
And they gave us bottled water.
Seriously, like right out of a movie. Right out of a movie. They were like, hey, I heard you guys were having a drought. Here's bottled water.
Hey, are you guys thirsty?
Yeah. And we were.
It's summer out there. And we were like, yeah.
This was a tale of thirst.
We were thirsty for a book.
True thirst.
We were thirsty for a book.
So anyway, we had this big show.
So we had a show. This is our book release. This is our book release party. Oh. As someone who's been doing book releases for every fucking person on
Everybody
earth
gets
for
a
goddamn
book
7 years, we had a book release. We got to stand on stage and be like, "This is our book." It was amazing. And you know what? Like 350 people showed up to it.
It was pretty impressive.
Can you even believe that? I couldn't even believe it. I still get chills when I think about
there
it.
There was two levels of people. There were people on the ground, people in the,
there were
in the
people
rafters,
above my
and
head.
We could see them up there,
they were
and they
yelling
were like
things.
Yelling.
It was amazing.
And having a grand old time.
And,
and there was a line around the building.
There was a line around the fucking block. It was unbelievable. I love it.
Amazing.
So thank you guys so much. It's you jerks that listen to this thing and show up every month. And I can't believe this thing became what it was. Like, I still can't believe it. And the fact that we have, like, a physical book on the shelf. I was just at Dogyard and Castro last night. They have our book. Cecil Baldwin just sent me a bunch of pictures from New York Bookstores that carry it, because he's back in New York now after his, like, whirlwind London trip. And he's sending me fucking pictures of bookstores in Brooklyn that carry it. Like, everyone carries this thing. Can you believe it?
We gotta put a bounty out.
There's a bookstore in Miami carrying it.
I want to see pictures of every bookstore that's got.
Please send us photos. Oh my God. If you are in the wild and you see pictures of our book, send us a photo. We're usually either in humor or anthologies or both. Please send us your photos.
Please.
I'm obsessed with finding my book in the wild. It's unbelievable to me that people please carry. I went to Long Island. I'm from there. Sorry. I have to admit that every time. I went to Long Island to visit my family in October when we were there for Comic-Con this year. And my family was like, well, why didn't you bring us copies of the book? And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess I should have done that. But I didn't feel like traveling with them. And also, can't you just buy them? But anyway, that's a different story. So I went to this Barnes & Noble that is now in this place where the Borders that I used to work at was. And they had like 4 copies of it. That's a huge position for a Barnes & Noble to take on an anthology about porn.
Yeah.
Like, that's huge. That blew my mind.
I mean, for what we've been told, the book is selling everywhere.
It's doing well. You guys, thank you so much. Like, I have been a bookseller for 15 years. Like, you don't even know. I'm dying. So anyway, let's do our podcast. So we decided, we picked for our book launch, we did The Princess Bride. I don't know why we picked it, but it was a good choice. It was a really good choice.
I agree.
It was hilarious on two coasts. It totally fucking killed. And for the first time ever, you get a surprise guest story from your boy here.
Oh, me.
Who jumped in the last 24 hours when a writer dropped out. So everything is great. Everything's great.
So
it was on the day of my 10-year wedding anniversary.
This is our San Francisco show.
So this is our San Francisco.
We're
going to
have
show.
A New York show. One thing that makes this one special, in addition to me filling in the last minute, is that our longtime reader, Baruch Porras Hernandez,
yes.
is a first-time writer. So Baruch and I both, this was our first time writing for Shipwreck. And it's because we had the lovely Cecil Baldwin here to read for us at our book release in San Francisco, which is it's topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
Like,
it's
who would anticipate?
It doesn't,
nothing makes sense.
Cecil Baldwin has been doing the show in New York for years and years, and he loves the show, and I love Cecil with my whole heart and soul, and he was so kind. He was just kind of here at LA Podfest, and then just was like, yeah, I'll come to San Francisco, whatever, who cares, and just, like, did our show. Because he loves our show.
This is the only thing
he's
did
so
here.
He's so fucking great.
He
I
came
know.
Up and did our show.
It was just a guest appearance at our stupid show. I love him so much. Anyway, so all of our thanks to Cecil Baldwin for being there for our book launch and making it special.
And we
all
wouldn't have thanks. The book without him. So,
exactly.
like, it's just.
We
thank
wouldn't
you.
Have the book without
like,
him.
Thank you. Like,
thank you to Cecil, always, who we thank in our acknowledgments. Thank you to Maddie, who we thank in our acknowledgments. Thank you to the Public Works, SF, for having us. What a great fucking venue. Go to everything that they do. They throw a hell of a dance party there. I love that venue.
And thank you
to the
Booksmith
for
like,
selling books for us, for
perfect
providing
partner
an
for
entire
us.
Staff for us to launch this stupid thing in style. It was the most fun I've ever had in my life, and I got to wear pink sparkly shoes, and thank you all.
All right, let's hear some porn.
So let's do it. So we started with Vizzini, who's the inconceivable guy.
So this one's called Vizzini Monologue. They used to call me the Sausage King because my dick was like one of those Vienna sausages, short, fat, and filling women with delight. Oh! I mean, I really got around. When a chambermaid saw me, it was like the OPD was in the house. They just spread them. No, I want to be clear. I was the original pickup artist. These modern-day PUAs have got shit on me, acting like they invented the idea of women as pigeons and doves, insulting women and making her coo like a turtle dove. I invented that. Anyway. I think it's why the author had a vendetta against me and killed me faster than a season on The Mob Wives. I was too much Italian for all of them. Think about it. I'm the wise guy, and I'm the first one killed. And now I've brought shame upon my family. Turpitudinem, as the Latins would say. My mother, my nonna, my nono, they don't even say my name. They just call me dead dumb fuck. How did I die before the Spaniard? Inigo with his hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father, prepared to die. This guy is a goddamn meme now. He's not even a putz, first of all, because he's not Jewish. And second of all, ain't nobody think he's sexy. Inconceivable. And it's supposed to be hilarious that I die by a battle of wits. I lose to the man in black who looks like a second-rate El Zorro with a do-rag. I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown? I amuse you? I'm here to make you laugh? I'm here to fucking amuse you? What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny? The author did me wrong. You don't kill a Sicilian first. Those are the rules. It's like this limp dick writer got a hard-on for the man in black and never read his Dante and got stuck on his Don Quixote instead. Maybe that explains the Spanish conquistador cosplay. And now the man in black and Buttercup are in a field somewhere looking at each other longingly and not fucking. He's putting his hands on the nape of her neck gently, and she's looking off in the distance, talking about some moron who's dead, and it's all supposed to be very romantic. Boring. If I was writing this story, Buttercup wouldn't even be a character. I never got turned on by that sort of thing. You know, the loyal, steadfast chick with tits like suction cups whose virtue was wrapped up in her virginity and her beauty. I had to spend weeks with her, and the girl had nothing to say. So what exactly was everybody fighting for? Nah. If I was writing this story, Buttercup would be a Zoftig pirate who is unquenchable. Bitch would be thirstier than a Kardashian in a field of rappers. It would be like the hop on pop of Cox. Except she'd be fucking all these assholes you already met, and the whole thing would end in a glorious fire and orgy on a ship. Fuck the man in black. I was too good for this world.
And that was Vizzini, as written by Michelle Threadgold, who you will remember from
a few podcasts ago. Yeah, she's wonderful. Again, like, wonderful Bay Area Latina writer who writes about punk rock and music scenes, and she's great. Read everything she does. I adore her. And then, next up, we have Wesley.
So this one is called Port of Call. From the docks of Daggerville, the pirate ship Revenge looked more careworn than imposing. But that didn't stop passing midshipmen, boatswains, and artisanal small-batch leather workers from dropping their eyes to the piss-drenched cobbles as they neared her bulk. Even in the most remote and cutthroat of privateering ports, the name of the dread pirate Roberts carried enough weight to transform the toughest of toughs into the toughest of lambs. Which is to say, people gave him a wide berth. Having acquired the necessary provisions of rum, salt pork, and books on tape for a month or so of marauding, the captain had turned his attention to oils. Whale oil for the lamp, of course, but also oils for conditioning the ropes and decks. Oh, not to mention flaxseed oil for his morning smoothies. Yes, Mr. Roberts, I assure you this is the finest cannon lubricant sold in the world's waters. Roberts frowned. It's not that I don't believe you, Jim. It just doesn't smell very sensual, is all. The vendor frowned at this. It is true, I'm afraid, but is anything so sensual as the tang of gunpowder entwined in the frantic delight only one discovers at the sword's edge? How might mere oil compete? Robert sighed. You're a goddamn poet, Jim. I don't understand a word you just said, but I'll sure as shit take a barrel of whatever you're selling. My valet can handle the particulars. And he motioned for a young sailor standing attentively at some distance to conclude the transaction before turning his attention to a display of pocket silks a few blocks away. Okay, so by now, I'm sure you've realized the young valet was Wesley. William Goldman here. I wrote the film All the President's Men. And I actively dislike women. The setting for this scene, Daggerville, is so near to my heart that it practically pumps my blood. The name has changed since Morgenstern's day, and there are more chalk-white tourists and resort hotels than seamen and scooters, but I'll treasure until my dying breath the extended weekend I spent there with Andre. Shortly after we'd wrap production on the film, this would have been 86, I guess. And I was more in love than I'd ever been. He was so strong, yet deep in his tree limb fingers was tenderness that gave meaning to Morgenstern's otherwise bewildering passage near the cliffs of insanity about the sort of religious awakening made possible only within the embrace of a mountain. He was my Fezzik. In this way, I am like you, me, the guy who wrote Butch and Sundance, like you. Go figure. He was your Fezzik, and he was mine. I like to think Morgenstern would have understood. Even now, as I reabridge this expanded edition in anticipation of the book's 50th anniversary, I find myself defending this innocuous chapter involving the education of our farm boy at the hands of Roberts. Fact is, the Florinese were leagues ahead of their dowdy European contemporaries in matters of embracing non-binary lifeways, and my truest hope is for contemporary publishing to catch up. Anyway, my great-grandkid's a real piece of work. He only likes stories about teen magicians and misunderstood vampires. Kids are a mess of idiots nowadays. When I was his age, I liked two things: baseball and boobs. Point being, I added some vampire stuff to the original prose to keep the little waffle iron interested. The dread pirate Roberts lit a cone of his best incense and reclined on one of the many velour chaises in his well-appointed captain's chamber. "Tell me," he said, addressing Wesley, "do you think it's weird that I am notorious for murdering scores of people? I mean, that's my whole thing, right?" Wesley searched for the words to respond. It is your thing, I guess. Like, yeah. I think if at some point down the road you were to reunite with some loved one from the past, it might come up. Like, even if they didn't call you on it or something, it would probably gnaw away at you while you slept or when you looked into your child's eyes. You might say to yourself, did those men not have fathers? Did they not love? And at the same time, though, I don't think lions cry, if that means anything. The pirate's silken night shift slipped with the swaying of the Revenge on the open sea, revealing a hint of flaccid, devil-may-care shaft in the flickering lamplight. "What if," he said with a grin, "I were to tell you that everyone I'd ever known had died ages ago, that I was no more a man than I am the true dread pirate Roberts? What if, my young friend, I were to tell you that I hadn't aged a day in 100 years, and that I was willing to pass this gift onto you?" The silence was full of creaking boards and wind noises. It lasted an eternity before Wesley set his jaw and said, "Mouth stuff, and you can come on my belly." William Goldman again. Now, it's worth saying that things got hot pretty quickly in this revision, and it's no good for my dipshit great-grandson. So I wrote a whole different thing where Wesley went to some kind of pinky-finger-out private school for gifted children who can talk to swords. The kid loved it, and it's already been optioned by Netflix for some kind of cartoon show with Zach Galifianakis and Amy Sedaris. Which is to say, this draft is just for me. Even now, as I write this aside to myself, I'm at a loss for whether this device is clever or sad, or whether I'm too old and successful to care anymore. The fact is, you never forget the first time you heard Berlin's Take My Breath Away and really felt it. For me, it was in a seaside inn on the coast of Barbados with my dear friend Andres, cyclopean hands kneading the meat of my shoulders. Since the invention of the back rub, etc., etc., etc. Even though this old man's musings about moments and friends passed, these dicks aren't going to suck themselves. And I, for one, am interested to see how this turns out.
And that was Wesley, as written by, oh, me.
Oh, who?
Me, Casey Childers.
Who? Who was that?
Who knew?
I think I wrote in my intro that he's like the prom king and the captain. No, the homecoming king, the captain of the debate team, and what did I? There's a third one. I can't remember. Anyway. Yeah, that's boring. Anyway,
oh, he's Wesley.
He's Wesley, you know. Okay, next up is Count Rugen, who is, he's
Christopher
guy.
Guest's character
he's
the in the movie.
Guy,
right? He's the six-fingered man, and he is the pain,
he's the torturer. Like, how do you not invite the pain guy, the pain expert, to shipwreck? By the way, did you read the book?
Yeah.
It was really different from the movie.
For sure.
It's a lot of, it's a lot of William Goldman just sort of masturbating onto the page about how great William
Goldman. Yeah, I think
Goldman,
he realized that he wrote
dick.
A good. Yeah, he's. I mean, he's one of those writers where you can't tell if he knows that he's writing a dick.
But what's so curious to me is he writes himself as a dick, which makes it like another layer of I can't tell what you're doing.
Yeah, like it's hard to tell. And also,
like,
I think he's making fun of his fat son. I think he's from that other time,
I think
it's like
I think it's a generational thing.
I think it's sort of like, you know, pulling your pockets out of your pants and saying that you're. One-eared elephant or something like that. Like, it's just like a dad joke. dads.
Is that a thing that dads do?
Yeah.
We don't know that thing.
It's an old
time. I don't have that kind of dad. I have the kind of dad that tricks me into telling time backwards, so I don't fucking know. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that he's sort of like a reverse Stephen King. Like Stephen King like has two drinks and turns into like the most sentimental dad ever. William Goldman just like wants to be a spy, but it turns out that he's just a regular dad.
But he's just actually a dad. Actually, I feel like that's a pretty accurate read on him. I think that's about right. Yeah, that's good. Oh my god, that's so funny. Okay, so that's Count Rugen.
The Count. Count Tyrone Rugen of Florin loved power. He loved having it. He loved thinking about having it. He loved proximity to it, which was good because he was just a count and didn't have that much power. There was only one thing that Rugen, also known as the six-fingered man, due to an additional appendage on his right hand, loved more than power. Pain. He loved to inflict it, to dream about it, to read everything he could about it. While at the University of Florin, his research into torture and agony had culminated in a lengthy thesis that detailed his vision for the machine, the greatest torture chamber ever. His advisors failed to see his genius on the matter and instead felt kind of uncomfortable, which left the Count ABD. Thank you. He was angry at first and then realized it was the best possible outcome. To hell with academia, he declared. I'm not going to write about the machine. I'm going to build it. It took him 20 years of delightfully backbreaking labor to construct the massive apparatus. And now, it was ready. The Count had just arrived at the secret dungeon lair when he kept the machine, when he was greeted by his hunchbacked albino assistant. Sir, panted the hunchback, your first victim has arrived. Rugen's pulse quickened. His heart thumped. His cock rose just enough beneath his favorite emerald-encrusted codpiece. He ran down the dank spiral staircase to his precious machine, and lo, there was Wesley, the princely, gorgeous farm boy, spread out and shackled, his hands hanging limp at the wrists, his legs spread as wide as the sky in summer. His golden head hung, his chest bare and taut, his pants ripped at the knees, the thighs. He was on the machine, and he was ready. Wesley. The Count's nostrils flared as he took in the sight. Hello, Count. Quite a situation you've got here. This machine sucks away your life force. The Count's voice was low, an evil purr. Does it now? Wesley's smirk sent chills up the Count's inner thighs. His codpiece felt even tighter. Indeed, it's my life's work. Congratulations. And how exactly does it work? Suction cups. Wesley laughed. It sounded like bells, like angels ringing a bunch of bells. The concept of the suction cup is centuries old, the Count continued, defensive. It's an ancient practice, thoroughly proven. Really? I've not seen much about suction cups in the literature of torture. That's absurd. These are the best suction cups. They're terrific. This is the greatest form of torture. He stopped and took a breath. Took a deep, shuddering breath. Focus, Rugen, he told himself. He reached up and pulled the lever so that it aligned with the number 1. We'll begin here. Wesley's body immediately seized, convulsed, twitched. The Count pulled the lever back to 0 and picked up his notebook. On a scale of 1 to 10, he asked, calm, how life-decimating was that? Wesley tried to speak, but only ribbons of drool fell from his lips, streaked with thin red bloodlines. 4, he finally managed. Interesting, the Count said. 4. And jotted the response in his notebook while Wesley writhed on the slab. What's the extra finger? Stammered Wesley, who gasped for air between each word. Oh, This? Rugen held his gloved right hand aloft and wiggled his six digits. He stared right into Wesley's pale blue eyes. Helps with grip. And he pulled the lever again, this time up to four. Instantly, sweat poured from Wesley's chest, racing down along his ribs onto the cruel slab that held his shackles. The suction cups pulsed and pulled, and Wesley's head wrenched back, his mouth a cavern out of which erupted the deepest, foulest howls the Count had ever heard. The Count smiled. His cock found a way to harden even more. And with each howl, he swelled against the tight, jeweled codpiece. The Count dropped to the cold stone ground. Wesley, who felt as if his entire being were being fried in a vat of rodent blood, as though he had snorted a mile-long rail of iocane powder. Wesley, in the midst of this excruciating misery, suddenly felt pleasure. Warmth. Heat. Wet. A new kind of suction, a hot, burning joy. With all of his strength, he lifted his head and looked down, half-conscious, to locate the source of this rush of good. How was it possible to feel such pain and such pleasure at the same time? The Count's head rose and fell, his hair falling in thick raccoon tail-like clumps around Wesley's majestic cock, which rose like a glistening unicorn's horn from his thrashed and bloodied body. Wesley watched as the Count bobbed on his crotch, and then as the black-gloved, six-fingered hand crawled up across his thigh, over his belly, up to his chest. Along the way, it fondled each suction cup, circling red, raging rings around each one, and then made its way to Wesley's mouth, parting his parched lips and running light along each ugly-ass farm boy tooth. And all the while, his regal Count head bobbed on the wake of Wesley's hips like the dread pirate Robert's first boat. Not the huge one he has now, but the shitty little one he darted out with that was way more sensitive to the ebb and flow of the wild dark sea. The six finger hooked around Wesley's bottom teeth, pulling down his shaking jaw. The Count's lips tightened around the glorious cock. And then the Count reached out with his other hand, grasped the lever, and turned it up, up, past 5, 6, 7, 10. A gate opened and water rushed in, and every single suction cup increased its ferocity by 100%. Wesley's body stiffened and arched, and every part that was not shackled to the slab lifted up in horror. His muscles contracted and expanded with such rigorous fury that his now raging pants split entirely, exposing his pale, pulsing buttercups. The Count wasted no time. He wrenched his sixth finger from between Wesley's clenched teeth, which ensnared it like an R-O-U-S trap. He waited until Wesley's back was in a full peak spasm, and then he rammed his sixth finger up into the young man's glorious, princely asshole. That is what it's for. The Count said, with Wesley's dick still in his mouth. Now tell me, how do you feel? Wesley could only howl a ghastly, otherworldly sound that echoed throughout the entire kingdom, worse than the clamor of 10,000 dogs trapped in the fire swamps. Miles away in her turret prison, the lovely Princess Buttercup heard his agony. Her nipples hardened and she crossed her legs really tight. And at that exact moment, Wesley's endured its greatest spasm yet. Cock erupted, his jizz exploding in a glittering spray of fierce cum magic, drenching the Count's entire being with the milky byproduct of horrific, perfect pain. Then Wesley, drained of his life force, lay still, limp, sweet, as you wish, murmured Rugen. And he bent over his notebook to jot down the details.
That was Count Rugen, as written by Muffin McHugh.
That is obviously a fake name, and I will not tell you who actually wrote that piece, but I will say, apropos of nothing, that I think you should all go out and buy a book called Red Women Worldwide.
For no reason.
For no reason. Has nothing to do with this podcast. Okay. Rodents of unusual size. When we announced that we were doing this book, the number one question I got from, like, four people on Twitter was, like, you're not going to include the rodents, are you? And I was like, bad news bears.
We had to.
Bad news. Sorry.
Okay, so this one has a title. And that title is The Jizz Bucket List. Open it up. I need you to read it to me out loud, the old man said. He smiled, remembering all the great stories his grandfather had told him when he was a kid, especially that magic day he read The Princess Bride to him when he was sick. He looked down at the stained manuscript. Grandpa, is this another story about fencing, fighting, true love, and miracles? No, it's about dicks. What? Big dicks. Gooey dicks. Delicious dicks. Okay, this was getting weird, he thought. Was dementia setting in? He read the title. Grandpa, what the hell did you write? Is this fan fiction erotica? That's right. A kissing book. His grandson slowly started to get up. Wait, just wait. Look, it's my dying wish. Who else is going to read it to me? The nurse? Come on, we're both adults and I'm on my deathbed. He takes a deep breath. All right. That's my boy, says his grandfather as he snuggles himself in the bed, ready for the story. Wesley sat at death's door in the center of the COUSSSS Club, Florin's notorious gay sex club, which stood for Cocks of Unusual Size, Sassy Sexy Shack. Run by giant ugly rodents, or R-O-U-S, rodents of unusual size, or whatever. The sex club was in the middle of the thieves' forest where Wesley had gone to live after realizing that Princess Buttercup was boring as fuck. All that adventure and rescue for nothing, sure, she was pretty, but she couldn't make him come, and she was, oh, so basic. So basic that when he jumped out the window and said, oh no, I've been capped by that pirate guy again. As he hid in the bushes, she believed him. He sat on a throne bedazzled with pink gems. The inscription in diamonds on the back of the throne said, Yas, Queen, Yas. In front of him was a line of the most beautiful men, like ever. Word had spread that Wesley had come out of the closet, was in Bummer Town City, and would soon die if someone didn't give him the most passionate kiss, the most pure, the kiss that would leave all others behind. So, all sorts of hotties came to give this a try. The first to try to kiss Wesley back to health was Jude Law. But he was booed away after a kiss that tasted like 1999. So mean. Then Mike Coulter, the hot guy who plays Luke Cage in the new Netflix show, made out with him for like an hour, but nothing. Someone entered, looking like he could ruin a literary career with his tiny cheekbones. Oscar Wilde's lover, Lord Alfred Douglas. But he just creeped Wesley out. It was kissing evil yogurt. Steve Yeun, who plays Glenn on The Walking Dead, came in looking dashing as fuck and kissed Wesley, but still, no sparks, no hard-on. Wesley was beginning to lose hope. "What about me?" said Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet Leonardo DiCaprio. Leonardo Twink Caprido? Wesley raised an eyebrow. "Twink, what's in that name, Twink? A twink by any other name would still be as beautiful," said young Leo. "And annoying," said Wesley, shooing him away. "I could read you some poetry," said enfant terrible Arthur Rimbaud. Wesley scowled and said, "Poetry, ew." Suddenly, someone kicked the doors to the sex club open. "My name is Gelgasir Banal. I've come to kiss you. Prepare to jizz. All over yourself." His voice was sensual, powerful. All the other men in the sex club got hard right away and slowly began to take their clothes off. Even the R-O-U-S-E-S got hard. 1980s Cary Elwes Wesley may be the prettiest man alive, but Pedro Almodovar's 2004 Bad Education Gael García Bernal is the sexiest man in existence. "I'm here to give you that epic kiss you keep whining about, gringo," Gael said with his green eyes that held the universe inside them. And he was dressed like Inigo Montoya. The safe word is La Safe Word. And then he pinched Wesley's nipples hard and used them to pull Wesley toward him to lightly but quickly chew and suck on Wesley's neck as he unbuttoned Wesley's shirt. Wesley could not believe how turned on he was. As Gale bit down on Wesley's beautiful shoulder, he ripped open his shirt and he flicked and pulled and pinched at Wesley's nipples harder and harder, making Wesley call out in pleasure. And then, surprise, as he looked down and saw that he was hard, Gael got down and undid Wesley's pants and belt buckle with his teeth. Wesley's fantastic large cock bounced out. An 8-inch pale veinless shaft with a bright pink, strong, shiny head. Gael García Bernal pulled off Wesley's black pants, ripped off his mantis, and sucked on Wesley's cock for hours, never stopping the severe pinching of Wesley's nipples. Wesley's face was sweaty and red. He had been moaning for so long, his voice was tired. At this point, all the other men in the sex club had stripped off their clothes and were beating their meats as fast as they could. There were all sorts of dicks. Big dicks, small dicks, lefties, righties, gooey ones, shiny ones, grouchy ones. You know what I'm saying? Wesley was in heaven. Gael García Bernal grabbed Wesley's legs and thrust his knees toward his shoulder. "Time for the most perfect kiss in the whole world," said Gael, and plunged his tongue right into Wesley's plump white ass. Wesley screamed with shock and pleasure. Gael's tongue fluttered, then probed, then lapped like a dog drinking water. He caressed the rim, then sucked on it a little, then French kissed Wesley's anus like they were in Paris. And as he tongued deeper and deeper, he jerked Wesley off. Wesley panted like a girl in an 80s porno. Gael never broke eye contact. He put his tongue as deep as he could into Wesley's anus and then started shaking and vibrating his jaw. Wesley's body began to feel warm and relaxed and high at the same time, and Gael began to tongue-fuck Wesley hard and fast. Wesley's body tensed up, began to shake and vibrate. Gale bit down on Wesley's taint. Wesley opens his mouth, but no sound comes out. Then a long, sensual moan, and jizz explodes out of his cock. It was so much spooge. It rained all over the club, over the R-O-U-S's, the men, the chairs. Then Wesley's second orgasm made Gale and all the other men come. Everyone was covered in git and jizz. But Gale kept eating Wesley's ass. Then a third orgasm erupted from Wesley's body, and that sent an energy shockwave out into the world, making everyone in the thieves' forest have an orgasm. The shockwave kept going, making all the adults in the land, in the farms, in the castles, cream their panties and jizz all over themselves. It was the best orgasm the people of Florin had ever had. Gale and Wesley lived happily ever after. The end. He hears his grandfather bust the last nut of his life. Then slowly fade, "Don't forget about me." His grandfather says. He thought about saying, "As you wish, Grandpa," but the old man was dead. He looked around the hospital room, notices he jizzed his pants too, and then says, "That was really fucking weird."
That was The Rodents of Unusual Size, as written by our own Baruch Porras Hernandez. Fun fact about Baruch Porras Hernandez is the first time that I did a show featuring the reading of Baruch Porras Hernandez, I did not know how to teach my mouth how to pronounce his name. And I said it like 16 times, and it always sounded stupid. And now I can say it like whatever.
Yeah.
But like the first time
he's very forgiving for our like sad floppy American tongues. He's like very kind about it.
It was weird because
he told me like the way that he pronounces it which is with a lot of like
porras.
Like tongue rolls and stuff. And he was like, "But it's totally fine if you can't do that. I don't care." And I was like, thank you, because I can't.
He's super chill about it, but even like the hyphenate and all that stuff, I was just like, I don't know how to do this.
Yeah. Look, the point is Baruch is a goddamn superstar, and follow him on Twitter at Baruch is on fire. B-A-R-U-C-H is on fire. And he's like one of the sweetest, kindest, funniest men I've ever met in my life. And did you see the other day he posted his little Beep and Friends for 2 years on Facebook
thing? Yes,
and
I did.
To cry.
I don't even know how I made it through this town without him.
I love him. He gives me hope for humanity. Yep. He really does.
He's the best guy.
Best dude.
You should be friends with him.
All right, we got a couple more. Fezzik is up next. Fezzik is the gentle giant.
Fezzik waited behind the boulder with bated breath. He had not fought a man in so long. Perhaps his skills would fail him against the man in black. The way his live body had shimmied up the cliffs of insanity, twisting and turning, his strong arms hoisting his slim frame up the jagged rocks. He could slip out of his grasp easily. He picked up the smallest, largest boulder on the hill as if it were a pebble. He let out a deep sigh, preparing for the oncoming battle. As the noise escaped his lips, the man in black was there. He had come so far so quickly, but he was barely winded. He stood on the mountain path, hands on hips, his strong rascal chin pointed up in a jaunty angle. At this short distance, Fezzik was taken aback by his beauty. Even though the dark slits of the mask, he could see the depths within the man's stormy blue eyes. How could one destroy lips so pillowy? Destroyed dimples like soft pockmarks in a loaf of his mother's sweet doughy rolls. Destroy a nose so finely sculpted Michelangelo would weep at the sight of it. And with a boulder, it would be like destroying a great work of art with a hammer. He could not do it, for no one else would ever know of the man in black's beauty, not even in death. Fezzik couldn't take that beauty to the grave alone. He threw the boulder past his head, where it exploded into dust. The man in black dodged it with nimble grace. You missed. I'm quite grateful. I did, but to bludgeon your face would be wasteful. For the compliment and my life, I am indebted. Fezzik paused, searching. You're lucky you're not beheaded. The man in black bowed slightly and quickly gestured adieu. I see that despite your size, you, like myself, are a man of fine vocabulary, he ventured. While I've never said a man could be too large, your exceptional stature weighs unevenly in your favor. Perhaps an agreement could be made where our battle could be fought with tongues? Fezzik chuckled. You could beat me with words, and it would be a shame if you and I couldn't fight hand to hand. I love to get physical. Well, it seems like we've used all the words we can, said the man in black. It's time we got to it. The man in black darted with feline reflexes, bouncing off a boulder and into Fezzik's chest. The surprise knocked Fezzik backward, and they tumbled through the gravel, blouses ripping to shreds. Their sun-kissed skin free from the chains of linen, they came to rest in a heap. The man in black lying spread eagle on the mountain of man. He groaned in pain, and Fezzik groaned in something far more lascivious. The man in black raised his black shrouded eyebrows. I thought we were fighting without weapons, and yet I can feel something poking me. Fezzik blushed. If you think that's a sword, you're joking me. Well, I knew you were a big lad, but I didn't realize you were quite that big. Fezzik leapt up from the ground, and they started thrashing at each other urgently, the man in black crawling over his huge form with fevered hands gripping in both pain and ecstasy. Fezzik tried to grab at him, but every time his giant paw gained a hold, the man in black would slip away. He would wrap around a tree trunk of a leg, trying to knock the giant off balance, only to slink up the length of his thigh as a huge arm swung down. The man in black would fling his athletic arms around Fezzik's neck, where his breath could be felt hot and ragged in his ear. I will finish you, giant. That I can promise. Fezzik trembled in anticipation. The man in black had wrapped his legs around his waist. The giant fell backwards into a boulder, crushing the man in black between it, attempting to loosen his grip. As the wind was knocked out of him repeatedly, the man in black pleaded, My fine fellow, we both know that what we want here, we could revisit my first proposal and conclude this battle with our lips. Fezzik was confounded and stopped smushing the man in black. But you would still beat me in a battle of words. He wheezed in pain and frustration. You really are being quite slow. I want to fuck you. You massive giant, I was being coy. You know, mask, battle, wordplay, I thought you would have picked up on my keenness. Glowing in anticipation, Fezzik thought long and hard about his next words. Well, does anybody want my penis? Yes. That is exactly what I'm saying. Sliding nimbly down from his back, the man knelt in the dust and with a few quick gestures freed the giant's member from his custom size 88 breeches. Wow. This is truly a POUS. Fezzik pondered, what's a POUS? A penis of unusual size. With the fingers of a master fencer and the lips of a master's wordsmith, the man in black went to work on Fezzik's mammoth manhood, but quickly found himself perplexed. Where does one even begin on a colossal cock like this? I don't know. Usually I fuck groups, so... They just all have at it until I'm finished. The man in black did his best to work down the length of his huge rod, licking and sucking, trying to fit it all in at once and leave no patch of swarthy skin untasted. The work was laborious, but rewarding. It seemed as if days had passed and he was still stroking and squeezing and spitting and licking. Fezzik's raging cock had never experienced hands with such dexterity before, or a mouth so voracious, or a tongue so lashing. He was approaching his limit quicker than he had ever before, and started bellowing a deep rumble at a pitch so low and fast, birds scrambled to escape from a nearby grove. The man in black tore his mouth away and stilled his hands, leaving Fezzik on the cliff of an orgasm that would be a further fall than off the cliffs of insanity. He looked Fezzik deep in the eyes. "Do you want to come?" Fezzik could barely get out the words, "More than anything." "Say what you want me to do." Fezzik struggled. "I want you to make me come." The man in black barely tilted his shaded and mysterious eyes and whispered, "As you wish." He descended on Fezzik's cock harder than he had ever before, testing every limit of endurance he had and worked that sword like legendary swordsman he was. He fondled and tickled and caressed with every fiber of his being until there was nothing left. Then he switched to his right hand. And stuck one small finger into the giant's enormous asshole. With that, Fezzik roared, and he came giant goopy ropes of semen all over the man in black's mask. As soon as he was empty, he unceremoniously passed out in a fit of ecstasy. A sleeping mountain on a hillside. The man in black wiped the cum from the holes in his mask and leaned in to whisper, "Sleep well and dream of giant penises."
And that was Fezzik, as written by Jane Harrison. The hilarious Jane Harrison.
I love her so much. She's like 24. Do you know that? She makes me sick. She's so fucking funny.
I saw her in a play when she was like 11.
When she was 11.
Not even joking.
Oh, you mean when we recorded our first podcast? We recorded Da Vinci Code months ago?
In real life, in Atlanta. I saw her in a play.
Oh, I didn't know she was from Atlanta.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
That's how we know each other.
Oh, my God. She is so fucking funny. I can't even stand it. She's going to be at Sketchfest. Go see her at Sketchfest. This is not going to post before Sketchfest. Go see her. No, that's January. I don't know when you're going to post these.
Who knows?
Who cares? Go see her.
Sarah.
She's me, Jane, you shut up on Twitter. You should follow her. Do everything she does. She's amazing.
And that brings us to the last one, right?
Yeah. The last one is Buttercup, who is the woman.
The woman.
Otherwise known as the woman in this story.
Literally,
is there another female in this book? I don't think there is.
Billy Crystal's wife.
She has like one line of dialogue. But she is played by what's her face in the movie, and she is so fucking funny.
Yeah, Billy Crystal's wife.
No, she's played by the landlord on Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah.
Whose name is?
I don't know.
I do. Hold
on. Now I have she's just one of those 80s people.
I'm sorry, I kicked you. Her name is Carol Kane. Carol Kane. I didn't even have to look it up. I remembered. So she's played in the movie by Carol Kane, but she literally has like a line and a half.
Yeah.
A note from S. Morgenstern. At this point, my wife wants it known that she feels violently cheated, not being allowed a scene of reconciliation on the ravine floor outside of the fire swamp between the two lovers. My reply was originally that A, each of God's beginnings from the lowliest on up is entitled to at least a few moments of genuine privacy, and B, I'm shit at writing about actual intimacy. And as such, rely on a combination of Wesley negging people to death and proclamations of true love from minor characters whose opinions seem dubious at best. But after she complained at such great and terrible length, I allowed her to write the scene she believed I had omitted. And that is what you shall read now. After striding gracefully down the hill, Buttercup pulled the man in black to his feet. He was dusted and bruised from his tumble, his mask askew, but he was her Wesley, all right. The man who just spent hours verbally abusing her and smacked her once on the face. That was her true love, according to the narrator. Which made sense, apparently. Buttercup narrowed her eyes at him. "You're a real cock," she told him. "Well, true love is complicated, and I wish I could push you down a cliff again," spat Buttercup. "Buttercup, my darling, my true love, you died," Buttercup shouted. "You, like, actually ghosted." But my true love, you keep saying those words. I do not think they mean what you think they mean. She looked around angrily. She was, like many of us, impatient to be rid of her high school boyfriend. "Okay, which way is the fire swamp? This way? You could not leave me again, not so soon after I have rescued you," Wesley pleaded. He tried in vain to take her hand, but Buttercup was too angry to be mollified. "Boy, bye," said Princess Buttercup. And she turned on her heel and walked with purpose and confidence into danger and darkness and into the fire swamp. Buttercup knew of the dangers, of course. She was aware of the fire bursts and of the ROUSs. For a while, Wesley trailed behind her, pirate-splaining these dangers to her again. Again and again and again. But she quickly lost him. And so, later, when she felt the undeniable feeling of being watched, she assumed it was Wesley, having finally caught up. Now, despite herself, her sex senses tingled. Maybe Wesley had come to prove himself worthy after all. I mean, she had liked him better not so long ago when he was obedient and doting and fetched snacks. "Show yourself," she called into the darkness. At first, she was answered only with silence. But she knew. Someone was watching her. Someone was there. "I demand you show yourself," yelled Buttercup. What she did not say was that she could feel, whoever it was, could feel their eyes as they traveled up and down her body, and that it was turning her on. To Buttercup's endless delight, the creature emerged. It looked like an actor in a low-budget rat costume. Crawling on all fours, and it bowed low before Buttercup reverentially. More like rodent of unusual sexiness, thought Buttercup to herself. It was her dearest and most profound sexual fantasy to be worshipped like a cruel Aztec goddess. She liked the way the rodent bowed before her. She liked it a lot. "I apologize," the rat said, "but I am living for your competence. Many humans enter the fire swamp, none survive, but you give me life. You are serving queenly goddess realness up in here." And the rat bowed again, low and artfully. "Obviously," said Buttercup. Her own fire swamp was running hot and wet. Buttercup didn't want to seem too thirsty, even though she was. She was the thirstiest woman in all the vaguely European made-up kingdoms in all the world. She was so thirsty, she was dehydrated. "My name is Rat," said the rat. "And full disclosure, I'm a messy Libra slut. a vector for infectious disease, and a total Hufflepuff. And if you're down and it would please you, I'd like to get super strange all over your body. Right here in the mud with our mammal parts. As I wish, Buttercup shouted. And in two urgent strides, Buttercup met Rat in an explosion of campy cult classic desire. Their bodies were instantaneously tangled as only a woman and a rat's body can be. Which is to say, with Buttercup's arm wrapped tightly around Rat's musky body, her fingers digging into Rat's fur, and Rat's tail inching slowly, sexily up Buttercup's skirt. Rat's paws, though tiny in proportion to the rest of Rat's body, pawed effectively at Buttercup's titties, making her nipples taut with titillation. Buttercup got so wet, the swamp became a mire. And then, after much expert teasing and stroking of Buttercup's pounding clitoris, Rat's tail finally penetrated her ravenous plot hole. Buttercup squirted so copiously that the mire became a cum marsh, which smelled fantastic. She and Rat scissored so vigorously, small fires broke out around them. Buttercup's labia minora rubbed against Rat's whatever it is that giant rats have. Her labia majora rudged against something furry and wet. Hairy taints smacked against hairier taints. Rat's tail found Buttercup's butthole, and Buttercup erupted into screams of pleasure. Convincing pyrotechnics exploded beside them, mimicking but not matching the catharsis of Buttercup's supernova of an orgasm. It may not have been love, but it was true. And it was hot. And it was gross. Rat came, and then Buttercup came, and then Rat came again, which made Buttercup come again too. Their cries and moans and grunts, a chorus of pleasure that rang throughout the swamp into Gilder and even echoed into Florin and, like, probably England also. Of all the fucking happening in the world, Rat and Buttercup's fucking was the hottest. Far away, Wesley wondered what all that yodeling was. He, of course, had never known the cries of female orgasm. Nor would he in his short and embarrassing life. After hearing the oral evidence of Buttercup's hitherto unknown erotic mastery, he stumbled into a patch of quicksand created by her seemingly uncountable orgasms and died. But like super slowly. I'll never fuck another human man again, Buttercup shouted. And she never did. After my wife read her tale aloud to me, her face pink with exertion, I broke the bad news to her. I don't get it. I said, what's the point? If her face had been pink, it was now red with fury. The point, she shouted. The point is that you have no concept of true love or female desire. Your male lead is a dickhole. Your narrator is a chauvinist. Everyone's sick of reading your self-indulgent asides. And also, in a related note, you are terrible in bed. Then she threw the papers at me and left to go masturbate. an activity to which it was made very clear that I was not to be invited. And then, rather like the buttercup of her tale, she never fucked me again.
That was Buttercup, as written by Maggie Takuda Hall.
If you're not following her fucking I'm Driving to the Fucking Southern Tip of South America podcast, you're doing everything wrong. It's called Let's Not Panic, and they have an Instagram, and they have a podcast, and they're hilariously funny. Please listen.
And you should be reading your kids also
way,
an octopus.
Maggie won. Of course. She always wins. I don't think she has she ever written a not fucking one. She's amazing. She's a fucking force of nature.
And that's
guys,
our show.
That was our book launch.
Holy shit.
Do you hear all the screaming? There's so much screaming. Oh Leave God. In as much screaming as possible. It's so good. Oh my God, they're so good. They're so good. Thanks everybody who came out to that show. That was the best night of my life. And look forward to the New York edition whenever we decide to cut it.
It'll come out right after this one, I guess.
Great. Cool. Okay, as you wish, bye. He used the word literary in quotes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he really professed
well,
to be super
literary. Well, my favorite
was
that he was really disappointed that he had never heard of the Princess Diaries.
It's true. He did say that. That is true. That is true.
So we're just going to call him Cockmunch for the rest of the night.
I support that and I love you.
Sorry, Cockmunch. Better luck next time.